It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we learn about an inspiring program that encourages people living with Parkinson's disease to explore dance.
First, University of Wisconsin System President Ray Cross said this week he's submitting what he calls a modest budget request to Governor Scott Walker as he prepares for the 2017 to 2019 budget cycle. Cross is asking for $42.5 million in general revenue funds for new UW system initiatives.
In addition, Cross is asking for the tuition freeze that lawmakers placed on the UW in 2013 to be lifted. But Governor Walker says he'd actually like to see it extended. Laurel White joins us now to talk more about the latest UW funding debate. She's WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Judith.
So UW System President Ray Cross says this is a modest budget request. Can you put that number of $42.5 million into context for us?
Sure. So the $42.5 million is actually less than half of what the UW system asked for last time around. So they submit their budget request every, on the even-numbered years. So their last request came in 2014, and they asked for $95 million in new funding last time. So as I mentioned before, this is about half of that.
And what did the UW system actually end up with in the last budget cycle?
Well, they actually ended up with a $250 million cut after they asked for $95 million in new spending. So they certainly didn't get what they asked for.
Has anyone from UW said exactly what those new initiatives that they're referring to would be that this funding would go towards?
They haven't been incredibly specific as far as how the funding would be divvied up between the universities or specific programs, but they have said that the funding would pay for increased advising services and programs that would help students graduate on time. They say that that $250 million cut has already had an impact on some students and caused them to graduate behind schedule.
And has Ray Cross said anything else specifically about why this particular amount is necessary in this biennial budget?
He just said that this is the amount that they need to maintain the quality at the UW system and to do things like ensure students graduate on time, provide adequate advising services. I spoke with him yesterday, and he reiterated several times that he thinks the request is very modest and very reasonable.
So after that $250 million cut to the UW system in the last budget cycle that you just mentioned, and that was in the face of the system asking for almost $100 million in additional revenues, do you get a sense that state legislators are maybe now more open to looking at additional funding for the UW system?
Well, we've gotten a little bit of feedback over the past 24 hours from legislators. One of the legislators to issue a public comment is Representative John Nygren, who is a co-chair on the Joint Finance Committee, which is a very powerful committee that determines the state budget. And he said that in his statement, he looks forward to working with his colleagues in the UW to preserve the quality and value of Wisconsin's public institutions. He also pointed out that legislators added $50 million back in from the governor's proposed cuts to the UW system last time around. You may remember that the governor proposed a $300 million cut. So perhaps some people could gain some hope from looking at Nygren's remarks, pointing out that restorative funding and his looking forward to collaborative work.
We're talking with Laurel White. She is WPR's state capitol reporter, and we're talking about the request that UW System President Ray Cross has made for additional funding from the Wisconsin legislature. And Ray Cross also requested that UW's tuition freeze be lifted. That was put in place by lawmakers in 2013. First of all, can you talk more about that? What does a tuition freeze really mean for the UW?
So the tuition freeze, which you mentioned has been in place since 2013, puts some limitations, obviously, on where funding can come from for the UW system. I asked President Cross if he was opposed to the tuition freeze, and he said that it's not entirely accurate to say that he's completely opposed to it. He said that he could support the tuition freeze if they did get funding in other areas. In other words, if they fulfilled this budget request of $42.5 million, because they would be able to provide services to students with money not coming from new tuition dollars.
And is that tuition freeze on both in-state and out-of-state tuition?
It is just in-state tuition.
So there is still the option of raising out-of-state tuition if that was really needed.
Absolutely.
So Governor Walker has made it clear in the past that he would like to continue the tuition freeze at least through possibly 2019. Has he weighed in on this particular request?
Yes. So the governor did submit a letter late last month saying that he does support continuing the tuition freeze for another 2 years. We got a little bit more information today from the governor's office. A spokesman said that the governor is willing to consider new funding for the UW, so that $42.5 million, if it's tied to performance measures. And this is something that the governor has talked about before. We don't have a lot of specifics about what those performance measures might be, what the metrics might be that universities would have to meet. But the spokesman did confirm today that the governor is open to that for new funding for the UW system.
And as we wrap up here, Laurel, the full budget request will be released next week before the UW Board of Regents considers it during their meeting on August 18th and 19th in Madison. What will you be looking for when the whole proposal comes out?
Well, as you mentioned, the entire Board of Regents has to approve that request, so it can't really move forward until they do that, and they could, of course, introduce changes, so we have to keep close tabs on this as it moves forward.
Well, Laurel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Judith.
That was Laurel White. She's WPR's State Capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about the latest funding request from UW System President Ray Cross and the potential response from the legislature and from Governor Walker. Right now, a groundbreaking program pairs professional dancers with people living with Parkinson's disease. This is not formal dance therapy, but instead it brings some of the balance and ease of motion back to people who have lost those skills.
David Leventhal is the program director for Dance for PD. His organization offers dance classes for people dealing with Parkinson's disease, which helps them deal with concerns related to balance, cognition, motor skill, depression, and physical confidence. He recently visited Wisconsin to help bring the program here. David, welcome to Central Time.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Well, give us a picture here. How does Dance for PD work? What happens?
Well, the idea is really that professional dancers and dance teachers share their knowledge, expertise, and joy of dance with people living with Parkinson's disease and their families and friends.
I wouldn't immediately make a connection here. What was the inspiration for doing this?
You know, a lot of people say, wait a second, dance for Parkinson's?
Right.
How does that work? This was an idea that was really brought to us by a woman named Ole Westheimer, who is the founder of the Brooklyn Parkinson Group. The Brooklyn Parkinson Group is a support group based in Brooklyn that started out really just offering monthly support group meetings, a chance for people to talk about living with Parkinson's and share tips and advice. And Ole had a vision for something else. She really wanted people in the group to have a chance to connect socially, to do something meaningful together, to do something creative together. And she settled on dance because she had a dance background. Around the time that she was thinking about this, she read about the opening of the Mark Morris Dance Center. The Mark Morris Dance Group is an internationally known modern dance company based in New York that had been without a home for many years. We finally opened a dance center in 2001 and really wanted to open our doors to the community. And Ole read that in the Times, New York Times, and said, well, I'm the community. What about us? And had a meeting and presented this idea. And we were very enthusiastic about it, even though we had no background working with people with Parkinson's.
I would think, I don't have Parkinson's, but I would think for someone dealing with that, the first thing they might think is, you want me to dance? Really? And you want me to dance in front of these professional dancers? What was the initial reaction from the people who participated?
Well, we started with a pretty small group. We had maybe six people, six brave people.
Yeah.
And at the time, there really wasn't a lot of evidence or even material about the benefits of physical activity for Parkinson's. I should mention that as recently as 20 years ago, physical exercise, physical activity was actually counterindicated for people with Parkinson's. It was seen as just too dangerous and could lead to falls. Mm-hmm. That's changed considerably because of a lot of research first on exercise itself, on physical fitness regimens. But lately, there's actually been quite a bit of evidence research on dance. And so, but when we started, to backtrack, when we started, there really was very little. So I think people came in with the idea that this was going to be a brand new experience. They had no idea what to expect. One of the things that we felt very strongly about was that this was a dance experience. It was not therapy. We are not dance therapists. We are not trying to solve a problem. We're simply providing an opportunity for people to engage with an art form, to learn some of the vocabulary, to learn what it's like to think like a dancer. And I think in that way, it became a double-edged sword because on the one hand, people could come in and for an hour escape feeling as if they are patients and really feel that they are dancers and focus on something other than the condition. And at the same time, they were really able to focus on all of the strategies and skills that dancers learn in order to move with fluidity and grace and balance and intent. And it's those elements, I think, that start to go away with Parkinson's. So if you were to create a movement form that addressed head-on all of the things that start to disappear with Parkinson's, it would look a lot like dance. And we actually already have dance in our lives, in our culture, so why not introduce that particular modality to folks who really want to address these issues?
You started, you said, with a small group of brave volunteers.
Yes.
How big is it now? How many people are participating?
So we started with a group of 6 people once a month. We now, in one location, and we now offer the same class in Brooklyn once a week for about 40 to 50 people.
Wow.
In addition to 6 other locations around New York City. Some of those locations are even bigger. We offer a class at the Juilliard School for about 50 people every week, and some other locations that are 20 to 30 people. But what happened in around 2007 is we started offering teacher training to other dance instructors from around the world who are very interested in this work. And because of that, the program has spread all around the world. We actually have a network of classes in about 140 communities.
Wow.
In 16 countries. I think there was a real vacuum that needed to be filled. People with Parkinson's who were hungry for a physical experience that was not simply about getting your heart rate up, that was not simply about exercise, but was actually about social connection, creativity, cognitive challenge, and a unique way of thinking about movement the way that dancers do.
I want to get more into the benefits in a minute, but it sounds like word got out and people were coming to you. What, dance instructors and I imagine Parkinson's patients, advocates, people like that were coming to you when they heard about this?
Yeah, it took a few years. I think there was a bit of skepticism at first, particularly from the medical community. But over the years, many people from a broad spectrum of constituencies have come to us because they're more and more interested in the value and benefits of dance as a modality for helping people with Parkinson's manage their symptoms and improve quality of life.
We're talking to David Leventhal about the Dance for PD program, teaching dance to people with Parkinson's disease. David, let's get into some of the benefits now. And you said this isn't physical therapy, so let's set the physical benefits aside for a minute.
Right.
It seems like with a condition like Parkinson's, people might want to give up, disengage a little, and it sounds like that is what you're tackling head on here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people with Parkinson's experience a fair degree of apathy. Just it's
understandably.
It's hard. You know, clinically, it's hard to get out. People have less energy. They have less motivation, and it's difficult to get around. What we found is that the dance class provides the kind of social glue and the sense of inspiration that a lot of people really are wanting in their lives, and it's an activity that people want to come back to week after week. You know, we all would like to get to the gym more often. We know it's good for us. We hear about the benefits, but when it comes down to it, it isn't the same kind of motivator as the sort of social environment, the musical environment of a dance class. And when we look at some of the research, we actually see a very high adherence rate, compliance rate, that regardless of their level of physical ability and mobility, that people want to come back to the dance class to experience that sense of connection week after week. And that's really what I think has been behind the exponential growth of this particular type of class.
You've seen a lot of people before and after, I imagine. What is that change like?
Well, there's a short-term before and after, and there's a long-term before and after. So the short-term is that people come into the studio shuffling, having difficulty coordinating, not really finding a rhythm or fluidity to their movement. And in the course of the class, it's sort of this melting, this idea that the rigidity and challenges that they have with Parkinson's often go away for a while. It's not that it's a cure in any way. It's not that there's any kind of permanent change. But we see people engaging with their bodies, moving with fluidity, moving with musicality that they ordinarily don't, and they certainly don't come in with. When they leave, they have a sense of satisfaction and confidence that we didn't see when they come through the doorway.
Is the healthcare community, the research community, looking at this, trying to see physical benefits, mental, emotional benefits, and measure them?
Yes, there are some excellent research projects going on, and what's useful is that people are looking at dance from a variety of perspectives. Some people are looking at it very traditionally in sort of the area of motor benefits, so functional mobility. How does dance class help people with balance? How does it help them with their walking and those kinds of activities? And that's very important because we need that data to make the case to neurologists. And I should say that over the last 15 years, there's been a huge change in how neurologists, at least in New York City, feel about the activity of dance. The beginning, none of them really batted an eye at it. And now most of the new participants in our classes come from referrals from neurologists in the city. And that's a huge change. Some of that is because patients go back and talk about their experience in the class. Some of it is from the research. So there's also research being done in quality of life, in how the dance experience, whether it's a social, emotional, expressive, cognitive experience for individuals, actually improves or helps people maintain a sense of humanity in the course of this condition and improves elements of quality of life, things like social inclusions, things like being able to express oneself. These are as important to me, at least, as the motor benefits, because Parkinson's affects the whole person. It's not simply a movement disorder. It's a quality of life condition. And because of that, I think dance plays a very important role because it is a holistic activity. It encompasses not just the physical, but the social, the emotional, and the cognitive. And in that way, I think plays a very important role in helping people maintain quality of life in the face of a chronic condition.
I'm curious about the dancers, the instructors themselves. They're approaching their craft, their art, in a very different way, translating it, I guess, to a different audience with different abilities. What's it like for them?
Absolutely. You know, it takes a specific kind of dancer and dance instructor to be sensitive and compassionate to this particular population. But I think once people understand that it is a dance class, they're not lowering their standards. It's just that they have a different way of thinking about the experience of people in the room. When I walk into the room as a teacher, I am trying to understand what it's like to be in their shoes, to understand what it's like to live with Parkinson's and to understand some of those challenges. But then I have to flip back and say, so what would I like to do as a person living with Parkinson's? What kind of movement would I like to do? What kind of music would I like to move to? What would give me a sense of fluidity and joy and freedom that I might not get in my everyday life? So really, that is the same as I would offer in a professional level class, except that in this class, I'm actually trying to engage much more in the imaginative and the creative realm, because often the sort of mechanical objectives, like lift your arm or move your foot forward, those are less successful than saying, I want you to imagine that you have wings and you're moving like a swan, or you're stepping forward across a beautiful flowing brook and you're walking into this amazing forest. So the more we can give people a sense of place, a sense of character, engage their imaginations in the service of movement, the more benefit they're going to have from that movement. And so in that way, it's a wonderful combination of sort of the technical, you know, the sort of step-based elements of dance, teaching people new vocabulary, but also having them understand that when they're dancing, they're entering this amazing creative space where they're actually in control of their bodies because their imaginations are telling them what to do.
You're here in Wisconsin, a whirlwind tour, but you're talking, I think, to healthcare professionals. What kind of things are you telling us here in Wisconsin?
So I'm here for a special summer school on mental health and older people. And these are people who specialize in geriatric mental health predominantly. And they're very interested in all kinds of approaches to help maintain quality of life and mental health, mental wellness through the aging process. Parkinson's doesn't only affect older people, but it is predominantly in people over 60. And in that way, I think bringing in and making people aware of an arts-based approach to movement, to socialization, is a really important ingredient or element that people can then use in their individual practice. It's not that everybody coming to the summer school today is going to leave becoming a dance teacher, but I'm hoping that they can integrate some elements of the creative work, the imaginative realm, and music into their personal practice so that their clients have some access to at least knowing about what the arts can do, what dance can do, and perhaps even engaging in some of that practice themselves, either through mirroring, through other sort of creative dance games that can be done very simply in a mental health session.
David, it's an amazing program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
David Leventhal is the program director for Dance for PD. He joined us to talk about dance classes for people dealing with Parkinson's disease. He came to Wisconsin to introduce healthcare providers to the program's methods. Today is the second anniversary of the shooting death of Michael Brown Jr., an 18-year-old black man, by then Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. The incident sparked protests around the country and jump-started the Black Lives Matter movement.
Chad Dion Lassiter joins us now to talk about this anniversary and whether progress has been made since the death of Michael Brown. He's the president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. Good evening.
So how significant is this second anniversary of Ferguson?
I think the second anniversary of Ferguson is really, really significant in the sense that we can see what we still need to do and what we have done. I think we still have an anthology of police brutality in our democracy, and we need to really start talking about best practices, both from a community level, from a federal level, and from a police level, so that we can make our community safer for both law enforcement and for the citizens.
As we just mentioned, the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson started the Black Lives Matter movement. That was certainly not the first time that a black man had died at the hands of a police officer and a white police officer at that. Why was Ferguson such a spark for that movement?
I think because what we have is the ushering in of a new generation of social change agents who are using innovative things like a hashtag, a die-in where previous generations may have done a sit-in. I think what Black Lives Matter has also done was take the scars and the suffering from some black males and brown males and black females and brown females as well, being killed by some police officers with impunity, and said this is a positive way to speak back to some of these scars and suffering. Black lives indeed matter in our democracy. We get it that all lives matter, but in a democracy, it always has seemed to be that black lives have always been seen as three-fifths or second-class citizens.
And how would you plot the evolution of the Black Lives Matter movement in these 2 years since Ferguson?
I think they've done a tremendous job. I think what's lost on the efforts that they've done is that we tend to lump in some of the challenges we've seen from a violent standpoint with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter has been civil disobedience. It's been peaceful. And you will get individuals who will come into the movement, and you'll see some of the deviant behavior that we saw down in Dallas, that we saw in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. People will say, oh, it's a radical organization. It's not radical. It's an organization that emerges to simply say, listen, we need to do something about police who are paid servants, paid to protect and serve, killing some of the black males and brown males and females as well in our community. I think they're definitely concerned about, you know, the crime that they see in their community, but they're focusing on police brutality and the anthology of police killings.
Do you think there's anything that the Black Lives Matter movement might have done better or differently to further their cause in the last few years? Any missteps that you see?
Not missteps per se. I think that leadership is good to be shared, but I think that it should have been and still has the potential of being an infrastructure where you have identified leaders. But for the most part, these are young people who didn't ask for permission. They didn't go to the old guard, i.e. maybe a Jesse Jackson or a Al Sharpton, or who people identify as leaders in Black America. And they just wanted to find a way to bring attention to this. And I think they've done a tremendous job in doing so, and they have proven to have sustainable efforts in doing so.
And how far would you gauge the reach of Black Lives Matter right now? Has it gone past the boundaries of the U.S.? Is it global at this point?
It's definitely a global phenomenon. I think that's one of the things that we don't see with our mainstream media. But if you look at Democracy Now, or if you look at BBC News, I was in Norway back in March, and I was invited to Bergen, Norway, simply because some students saw me on Huffington Post talking about Mike Brown and Ferguson. You have individuals who are over in China, over in Brazil and Vietnam, who look like individuals who, you know, they want to bring attention to it, and they're holding up signs that reads Black Lives Matter. You have white students here in the United States and white people in general out in Cal Berkeley and various other places who are marching saying Black Lives Matter. And so it's definitely on all sides of the color line, and it's a global phenomenon.
We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter right now. He's president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about the second anniversary of the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And Chad, since Michael Brown's death, there have been other shootings of black men, recent shootings, including Alton Sterling in Louisiana, Philando Castile in Minnesota. Those have, besides being more fodder for the Black Lives Matter movement, also kind of reinvigorated the All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter hashtags and sentiments. Can you talk about those two movements and how they relate to Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think one, to say All Lives Matter when someone is trying to define themselves in a society that displays with implicit bias and microaggressions is this. It's just really disingenuous. You wouldn't show up to a HIV or AIDS benefit holding a sign, cancer matters also. I wouldn't go to a funeral where someone has been killed and say, you know, aloud, my son got shot and killed as well. Blue lives is not a life. It's an occupation. Blackness is non-negotiable. So when we look at Blue Lives Matter, that doesn't even make any sense to me. What does make sense is that we're to respect those officers who respect us. There are a lot of police officers in America who put their lives on the line. There's a fear of calamity that they will not come home to their families because they serve humanity. A farmer doesn't look at his crop and says to himself aloud, I have one bad apple. He says, this apple's bad. I need to get rid of it. And so the police department has to have individuals who will break through the wall of the blue wall of science, silence, and the status quo to really just step up and speak out against those individuals who are doing these killings.
I think, though, that something that needs to be acknowledged is that there is a lot of frustration and anger and grief about police officers who are killed randomly, as we saw recently in Houston and in Baton Rouge, that there are possibly maybe the best, most compassionate cops out there who are not being viewed because of how they act, but because of that uniform that they're wearing. What would you say to people for whom Blue Lives Matter is really a reaction to that kind of violence?
Well, I think that nobody promotes the violence of anyone killing police officers. I think in every community, in white communities, in black communities, Asian American, Pacific Islander communities, people know those officers who are good, decent police officers. I think we also know those officers who engage in the behaviors that we've seen in our democracy. Once again, being a member of the Blue Life Movement, being a part of the police department is an occupation that you choose. In our democracy, you can't can't choose to be African American. It's who you are. You can't choose to be an individual who says, well, because I'm black, maybe they're not going to kill me. It just seems to be a challenge in our democracy. And once again, nobody should call for retaliation in the manner that we've seen it. I think retaliation could be getting the United Nations involved, getting civil rights organizations involved, black and white humanity and all humanity coming together to speak back to the injustices of police officers getting off after killing, you know, black and brown people with impunity.
We're talking to national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter now about the second anniversary of the death of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think things have changed for better or worse since the Ferguson protests? What do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement? What work do you think needs to be done to improve the relationship between police departments, police officers, and minority communities in cities around the country? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation now with national race relations expert Chad Dion Lassiter about the second anniversary of the death of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri.
Have things changed in your community in the 2 years since Ferguson? Have you participated at all in the Black Lives Matter movement? What do you think about that movement, or All Lives Matter, or Blue Lives Matter? What would you like to see done differently when it comes to policing in your community? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And so, Chad, do you see any change over those last 2 years in relations overall between police departments and communities of color?
I think that it's hard to quantify just what we've seen. I know that one of the things that we have to do is continue to do the work. I think when we look at the DOJ report that emerged out of Ferguson, one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, are those recommendations being implemented? I know that all over the country there have been a coming together of law enforcement and community through neighborhood town hall meetings, cookouts, sporting events, and things of that nature. And that's all good. That's an initial first step. But we have to have a serious, frank conversation centered around, why is it that some officers view black and brown people with, one, suspicion, and then, two, in a stereotypical manner?
Let's go to the phones, and Tim and Marinette is up first. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm curious. Michael Brown, I thought, was shown that he had, in fact, been the aggressor against the police officer, that there were bruises on the officer, that there were fingerprints, Michael Brown's fingerprints were on the officer's gun. And so if in fact he was the aggressor, I'm curious as to why Black Lives would hold him up as the, for lack of a better term, the poster child for Black Lives Matter.
So, Tim, are you saying that Michael Brown in particular is not a good choice, but that maybe there would be other better choices?
That's what I'm questioning, mm-hmm. because it doesn't bode well for the movement to hold up someone who is not a sympathetic character. I mean, it's a shame that someone lost their lives. No doubt. You know, it's a horrible thing. But he was the aggressor, and from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. because I would like to learn.
Thanks for that call, Tim. And Chad, how would you respond to that saying, maybe Michael Brown isn't the best person to rally behind?
Well, who's the judge and juror? It's the same thing that we saw in the Trayvon Martin situation, this notion of how we really demonize one segment of the population and then how we look at another segment of the population. When you look at the killing of nine people in the Charleston, South Carolina church, Dylan Ruth was kind of humanized. We looked at him from a biopsychosocial perspective. When the Michael Brown, Darren Wilson situation occurred, Darren Brown went deeply down. He went into the deeply rooted stereotype. Well, I felt like I was going to lose my life. He looked like the Incredible Hulk. It's not about empathy or sympathy. If Michael Brown was the aggressor, he should have been arrested, not killed.
Thanks for that call, Tim. Let's go now to Deb in Monticello. Hi, Deb.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to reiterate really what your guest said, and that's when a movement begins, like the LGBTQ movement or women's rights movements, there's a statement that's being made. And when people are targeted, as both of those groups have, and as I believe black males have been, I think you have to start somewhere. And to me, this seems like a great way to start. And to take away from the group by saying all lives matter and blue lives matter, which, of course, all lives do matter. But this is one group who really needs to be looked at, be discussed, and figure it out, because it's not right.
Thanks for that call, Deb. And, Chad, let's also bring on Brenda and Granton next, and I'll have you respond to both. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I think the movement is a little ridiculous. The people that you have mentioned were committing crimes. I'm sorry. If you commit a crime, you put yourself in that risk. The young man was going after this guy, the officer. He was bigger. You know, it happens. Sadly, it happens. I know my daughter was murdered. But for these groups to go out there and now calling for having officers shot, and I have heard them, you know, they've had in protests where they have called to have officers shot and killed. It's ridiculous. And now you are also hearing to have that they're calling to have white people killed because of our skin tone.
Okay, so, Brenda, let's leave it there. I want Chad to be able to respond to both. So clearly strong feelings both for and against Black Lives Matter, Chad.
Nowhere in a democracy have you had an African-American or black organization, whatever terminology you want to use, that have systematically killed white people. It's never happened. White people weren't hung by black people. White people were not enslaved by black people. The individuals that are coming to the Black Lives Matter movement with the aggressive rhetoric are not members of the Black Lives Matter movement. In our democracy, blacks have always been looked upon as subhuman. The mere fact that the caller mentioned that Michael Brown was the aggressor and that Darren Wilson, who has the gun, has the law and has the badge. No one should be killed in the manner that Eric Garner was killed. No one should be killed in the manner the way the young man was killed in Dallas and in Baton Rouge, or Sandra Bland, and the list goes on and on. And then on the other side of the color line, we have Dylan Roof, who goes to Burger King. We have Timothy McVeigh, who walks into a courtroom of law. Ted Bundy, the Unabomber. All these individuals walk into the courtroom of law. White males are pointing guns at police officers, and police officers are telling them, put the gun down. Black males have their hands up and they're dying. So I don't care if Michael Brown was a high school dropout. He's still a human being. Michael Brown could have been an Ivy League educated individual, and he would still have been a victim of police brutality, given the anthology of police brutality with some white officers and the psyche of white supremacy. The previous caller is absolutely right. Black Lives Matter is a statement similar to the 60s. I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud. Martin Luther King comes on board, and Martin Luther King, he did some things to push the paradigm to say, let's start looking at black ministers when he penned the letter from a Birmingham jail. So it's not saying that all lives don't matter. In our democracy, we understand that white lives matter because we have white privilege. You don't have driving while white. You don't have the Fair Housing Act that discriminates against whites who are trying to get housing. You don't have a black employer telling white people that they can't get jobs. But you have Hispanic people who have to change their names from Jose to Joe just so that they can get an interview. And so it makes all the sense in the world to have Black Lives Matter. And once again, we have white individuals who have joined in this movement who said Black Lives Matter. And they have shown how black humanity tied to white humanity brings about ultimate humanity.
We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter, president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania, and we are talking about the second anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Let's go back to the phones and Greg in Madison. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good afternoon. What a great topic. I would like for your guest to comment on, in my opinion, Michael Brown was not the aggressor. I would like your guest to comment on the working relationships between district attorneys and police officers. Can a district attorney be fair and impartial when he has to investigate and potentially prosecute the same individuals that work with him to develop a case? I think until that dramatically changes, that there will not be a change fundamentally and the way that these things take place. I will take my comment off the air.
Thanks for that, Greg. So, Greg, bringing up a different element of, Chad, what you are saying about the systems that are in place and have been in place for a long time.
I think Greg stated it all. I want to thank Greg for calling in and laying out what I think is not asking me a question, but a brilliantly articulated analysis, in the sense that you need an independent prosecutor, because a colleague is not going to find a colleague guilty because they're working in concert with one another. Even when you look at some of the killings that have occurred, you haven't had white police officers or black police officers or officers of color come out and denounce some of these behaviors. And so, once again, the killings that we saw of law enforcement, we definitely don't want that to occur. But then we'll have a president of the United States who said, when you attack a police officer, you're attacking law and order in the democracy. But when you kill unarmed black and brown individuals, what is that saying? Well, to the African-American community and multiple other communities, even white communities with racial consciousness, is saying that you are still continuing to treat the African and the African-American as subhuman, or what Ralph Ellison said, invisible. So I think you need independent prosecution. I don't think you can rely on the Department of Justice. We may have to actually go to the United Nations, because it's bordering on being a human rights violation.
We're getting a little short on time, but I want to bring Josie in Sheboygan on the line. Hi, Josie.
Hi. I'm a senior citizen, white, and I agree that blacks have been discriminated against through all of the history of this country. And I think just maybe if they had said Black Lives Matter too, that way that nobody else could accuse them of eliminating everybody else, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Josie. And Chad, what would you say to that?
I think Josie has a good point, but once again, in the society, you don't need the two, because white privilege lets us know that all lives matter. Black Lives Matter is not a radical group. Black Lives Matter is to send out a rallying cry, a political cry, to say Black Lives Matter. It's a plea. Stop killing our brothers and sisters. Stop killing our cousins. Stop killing our nieces and our godsons and our goddaughters. See the humanity. If we're guilty of something, take us to arrest us. Send someone out to de-escalate, to engage in conciliatory methods, conflict resolution, but don't kill us with impunity.
In just the last minute here, Chad, what do you think can be done to rebuild trust between law enforcement and communities of color?
Well, I think communities of color can't have it both ways. They can't castigate law enforcement, and then when someone breaks into their home or does something deviant in their community, they want to call the police. I think communities of color also need to step up and speak out and try to push back against the narrative that is so pervasive in communities of color, no snitching. I think police officers have to continue to have anti-racism training, diversity training, and they have to see the humanity of all individuals. Police review boards with trusted community figures on those boards. And I think we still have more policies that we have to put in place with regards to cameras, with regards to prosecution, with regards to police officers not taking the tape, hiding the tape like they did in Chicago, and it emerges 18 months later. We have a lot of work to do. I think that we can turn this around, but the anthology of police brutality is deeply rooted in the fabric of our democracy.
Well, Chad, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania. He joined us to talk about the second anniversary of the shooting death of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.
The mystery of Gags the Clown has been solved.
If you hadn't caught the story, pictures of a mysterious and very creepy clown wandering Green Bay carrying black balloons have been catching national and international attention, leading people to wonder who Gags the Clown was and what he was up to.
The answer came yesterday in a Facebook post from the filmmaker behind Gags the Clown. Long story short, Adam Krause of Green Bay is making a short film about, yes, creepy clowns lurking in American cities. These grainy images of Gags, so-called, were part of a marketing campaign that was more successful than the filmmaker planned.
In his post, Krauss said he had been planning to keep the project under wraps for a little while longer, but because it got so much attention, including media calls to the police, it was time to let the truth out. Quote, because safety was our number one priority, we wanted to end it before anything was taken too far.
It was pretty creepy.
It was really creepy, I gotta say.
It, you know, it was posted as though the clown was hanging out at 2 in the morning with the balloons, and as police pointed out, there's nothing against the law about being a clown at 2 in the morning out in the streets.
But still creepy.
Still creepy, and the mystery is solved. So I guess we'll look forward to the movie now that our attention has been virally captured. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.